Springfield, Illinois, which is somewhere near the middle of the state of Illinois, the capital city. You can see the capital out there on the left, the C-SPAN school bus on the right. Abraham Lincoln's house from 1844 till the time that he left for the presidency in 1860-61, right there on the screen with some of the National Park Service Rangers there and on horses. And Norman Helmers runs this place with a lot of help. Visitor center not too far away. The Lincoln Herndon Law offices available to the public downtown. And the gravesite, which is out at Oak Ridge Cemetery, where Abraham Lincoln, his wife Mary Todd Lincoln, and three of their four sons are buried. The fourth, Robert Todd Lincoln, and his son, Abraham Lincoln II, are buried at Arlington National Cemetery, not too far away from the William Howard Taft gravesite in Arlington National Cemetery. Our two guests continue here in our parlor room at the Lincoln home at 8th and Jackson, include David Long and Edna Green Medford, two people who have thought a lot about Abraham Lincoln, and I want to go back. We've talked a lot about him so far. It seems like 3 hours isn't enough to even open the first page to deal with him. When did the war start in some earnest, and how many Americans were under arms in the early days, Edna Medford?
The war started in 1861 with the South Carolina firing on Fort Sumter. When the war first started, Lincoln had asked for 75,000 volunteers. He expected this to be a very short war. They were talking about perhaps 90 days, and I think Jefferson Davis did a similar kind of thing in terms of asking for volunteers, a few more recruits than quite what Lincoln had asked for, but no one expected the war to go on for as long as it did.
David Long, you pointed out earlier, 33 states in the Union at the time. How many were southern? How many were northern?
Well, there were 15 slave states. I suppose that most of them could be considered southern, Delaware, Missouri. 11 states eventually seceded. 7 seceded before the firing on Fort Sumter. When Lincoln called for troops to suppress the rebellion, 4 more joined that first 7. 4 border slave states, Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware, did not secede. And in some instances, as we've heard from previous callers, extraordinary measures were taken to keep them from seceding, particularly Maryland.
We have a call from La Jolla, California. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Brian. It's been a long time since I've been able to call in. Hope to see you, by the way, out here at the Athenaeum in La Jolla sometime.
Thanks.
I have a question. I'd really like to hear this gentleman, the historian, who I feel is one of the best you've had on. You've had some that I've questioned their accuracies, but I'd like him to really give a succinct explanation of the difference between what they call the Republican Party in Lincoln's time and what they call the Republican Party today, which I believe should be called the Conservative Party, not the Republican Party, but and the Democrats of Lincoln's time and the Democrats of today. I believe that Lincoln believed in a very strong central government, number one, and number two, he's a trial lawyer, something that's vilified by Republicans today, of course. But there are many areas when I believe the Republican Party of Lincoln's time was certainly more like the Democratic Party of today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, why don't we get both Edna Medford and David Long in on this one?
Interesting observation. The Republican Party of Lincoln's era, which of course was the original Republican Party, was certainly the progressive party, a political party of the nation at that time. It was founded as an anti-slavery party, founded as a party to oppose the continued joining of new states to the Union that where slavery would be sanctioned by law. The Democrats of that day, there was a party that was rooted in the South. That's where it was strongest. There was little Democratic concern about slavery, or about doing anything about slavery. There was a great deal of Democratic energy given to preserving slavery. So the caller's indication that seemingly politically, it's almost as though the parties have reversed themselves since that time is has some merit. Some people believe that it's not that the Republican Party changed that much, but rather the Democratic Party went from being a very conservative states' rights party then to, of course, in the 20th century, the party that is associated with a strong federal government and presence.
Adam Efford, anything to add to that?
Yes, we should keep in mind, too, that just as with today, people join these parties for a variety of reasons. So not all Republicans would have been anti-slavery, and not all Democrats would have been pro-South. And so we have to remember that there was a great deal of sectionalism, a variety of people in both of those parties, and certainly that's reflected.
Again, the number of people in the United States, of the 33 states, what was the total number back in 1860?
About 31 million people, total, between 20 and 23 million of those in the North. The North's population had been swelled by immigration over the years. There are not a lot of immigrants coming to the South, because they know they're going to have to compete with the labor of enslaved people. And so, in large measure, they stay away from the southern states.
Colum Davis is still with us. We'll take a call from Red Hills, Tennessee. You're next. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this series. Speaking of sectionalism, we have a little article each a week in our Nashville, Tennessean called Countdown 2000, and this was just a small article, and it spoke about a young Confederate who, on April 7, 1862, the second day of the Battle of Shiloh, he was captured, and after a few months in prison, he switched sides and served in an artillery outfit until he was discharged because of poor health. Then in 1864, he joined the United States Navy and saw action against Fort Fisher, North Carolina. His name was Henry M. Stanley. He became a newspaper correspondent, and he's famous for finding the English missionary David Livingstone in Central Africa in 1871. I just thought this was interesting because most of the people who... A lot of the men who fought for the Confederacy were not slaveholders. They were mostly cannon fodder. And even though the Scots-Irish who settled this area would fight at the drop of the hat and all loved a good battle, they were not as great an ideologue as the leaders of our southern states were. Please
thanks,
comment.
Thanks, Red Hill. Colin Davis, any comment on this?
Only that it certainly is true that the picture is a little more complicated than to speak of slave states and free states. In fact, in Tennessee itself, there were pockets of pro-Union sentiment that's famous in the Cumberland Gap area, for example, that a Lincoln Memorial University was founded later on as a result of the fact, in part at least, because citizens of the Cumberland Gap area had been loyal to the Union throughout the war. They weren't as dependent upon slavery. They were mountain people. And so, as in all history, the picture is a little more complicated than simple black and white.
Sacramento, California. Go ahead, please.
I've always thought it was interesting that Robert E. Lee, and I believe his middle name is Edward, has two names similar to two of Lincoln's sons, Robert and Edward. Do you know of any writers who've made reference to those two interesting ideas?
David Long.
I know of no writer who has ever treated the subject. I'd never thought of it myself before right now.
And to Medford, is there any way from your studying that you can get a sense, of, again, of what the relationship was between Abraham Lincoln and his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln? I mean, and how unbalanced was she?
She probably did. The possibility that she suffered from a mental illness. They were both very difficult to live with. And Lincoln himself had bouts of depression throughout his life. They were very two very different personalities, and so they clashed as a consequence of that. She was high-strung. She was very well-educated. She was an aristocrat. And Lincoln, although he was a self-made man and was able to rise socially through the years. He certainly did not have the background that she did, so there was a clash there as well. I think that she probably had good cause for some of her what's been considered outrageous behavior. He was never home. And I suspect that if he had been, if he perhaps had had been there, things may have been different. Who knows? But certainly she cannot be blamed totally for the relationship they had. I agree that it probably was a loving relationship, but there was tension there throughout their marriage.
David Long, why did he not run for Congress again after he was in for one term?
An agreement that had been made before he ran for Congress in 1846, involving some other central Illinois politicians, he really didn't have to honor it, but he did. And part of the character of Lincoln, we know, of course, is that he was an honest person, and he made a promise. He lived up to it. He stepped aside to let somebody else run.
David Long is a professor at East Carolina University in North Carolina, Greenville. Edna Green Medford is a Howard University history professor. He's been there for the last 12 years. And Colm Davis is in charge of the Lincoln Legal Papers based here in Springfield. We go next to Irwin, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello, and thanks to all on C-SPAN for all this wonderful program. I would like for your historians, please, to comment on Lincoln's hand, President Lincoln's hand in the promotion of his officers, if they could compare his leeway with perhaps his opponent, Jefferson Davis, and also the reason that the prompts this question is that I have a handwritten note by Lincoln that says, from much that I've heard at various times, and especially recently, I shall be very glad to promote Colonel Ingalls if it can be considered. And I always thought the wording of that note was rather curious. So how would this have been?
Got it. Ed in Medford.
He was very much a hands-on president in terms of his generals. Even indicated to them instances in which they should use different strategy, was very much involved in promotion, sometimes countermanded orders, went over their heads, talked with subordinates. He was very much involved in this war effort beyond, well, he took the whole title commander-in-chief literally, I think.
David Long?
Well, yeah, he had some bad experiences with generals fairly early on in the war at a time when he didn't take as much of a hands-on approach that led him to believe that oftentimes generals probably weren't going to be as aggressive as he would have wanted them to be.
What's the story about Abraham Lincoln visiting George McClellan and he refused to come down from his second floor in his house?
Yes. I believe it would have been November or December 1861, shortly after George McClellan had been made commander of all United States military troops. Seward and Lincoln and one of Lincoln's secretaries went to the house of McClellan. They had been trying to get some indication from McClellan when he was going to move, when he was going to do something. There was pressure being put on McClellan to take some action. They sat in his front parlor because he was out at a party at some occasion. And he came walking in that evening. Immediately his manservant told him the president and the secretary of state are in the front room. McClellan proceeded to walk upstairs to the second floor. Well, the three of them continued to wait for him for some period of time. John Hay finally gets up and goes to the manservant and says, "Where is General McClellan?" And the butler said, "Well, the general has gone to bed." Well, it's a slight of the president that I'm not sure... There's another instance that I'm aware of that is quite as glaring as that one.
Let me ask the three of you in a moment what one book, if you had to recommend one book, you would to people that don't know much about Abraham Lincoln and they want to get just a broad overview. We go next to Manhattan Beach, California. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you. I really love the program. Ms. Medford said that Lincoln was not... He didn't believe very much in organized religion, but several years ago we were on a tour in Washington, and we attended the church where Peter Marshall, a famous minister, had preached. And Catherine Marshall, we sat on the Lincoln bench, they gave us a tour afterward. And anyway, I had read that Catherine Marshall said that looked through the records of the attendance at that church, and that Lincoln had attended the church a number of times. So, anyway.
Adam Medford, what's your reaction?
He certainly does attend church rather regularly as a child with his parents. But as an adult, he does not do that. He never does join a church. And so that doesn't mean that he wasn't very much involved with study of the Bible, but certainly would not be considered a church-going adult.
Colin Davis, let me ask you about that book. You have one that would be your favorite you'd recommend to somebody?
Well, you know, Brian, there's hundreds and thousands of titles to consider, but my personal favorite is the most recent serious biography of Lincoln. It's by David Donald. It's simply called Lincoln. And it came out, what, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's a best-selling book. It's not an easy biography to read. Donald doesn't hand you ideas on a silver platter, but that's one of its virtues. He simply lays out a definitive account of Lincoln's life and develops a theme about a relatively passive individual, but also touches on all of the aspects of Lincoln that really make him so fascinating to all of us today.
David Long, is it one by him?
Collins absolutely right about Professor Donald's volume. He's also correct in that the interpretation of Lincoln as a passive president that Professor Donald gave is one that I and a lot of other Lincoln historians have some trouble with. But it's still a marvelous biography. I would also say Benjamin Thomas's
volume. The one I have right here. Yeah. This correct. Is one you can buy fairly inexpensively, right?
And And Stephen Oates, with Malice Toward None, is a very good biography of Abraham Lincoln.
And Medford, you have a quick recommendation?
It's very difficult to choose just one because he was such a complex individual, but certainly David Herbert Donald's Lincoln biography is one of my favorites. But I would suggest, too, that readers need to look at a separate volume done by an African-American, and that book, for me, would still be Benjamin Quarles's Lincoln and the Negro.
East Hampton, New York, you're next.
Oh, good morning. You've got a wonderful program.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask a question about the emancipation of the slaves in the District of Columbia. I have a collection of put together over many, many years of medals relating to emancipation of the slaves. And this one is a very crude one, and it's stamped on it, "Great joy to our race. The Emancipation Bill passed April 16, 1862, Washington, D.C. Now, I know the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by Lincoln on January 1st of 63. Was there any bill in 1862?
And the Medford?
I'm not quite understanding a bill for what specifically.
For the
larger emancipation. Yeah. What Lincoln is doing fairly early in the war, at least by the end of the first year of the war, he's attempting to get the border states to emancipate on their own. And so he's constantly at Congress he's at the individual states. For instance, he's attempting to get Delaware to do it first and foremost. And then he's urging Congress. There are a variety of emancipation measures that do occur, starting with the first Confiscation Act of 1861, in August of 1861. Then there's a second Confiscation Act in 1862, in June, I believe, of 62.
Colum Davis, if I counted right, he had Mr. Lincoln had 5 appointments to the Supreme Court. That number track with you?
I believe that's correct, yes.
We can, we'll find the slide and put it up on the screen. What impact did he have on the Supreme Court from what your knowledge is of his legal history?
Well, of course, those appointments were important ones, and that's his principal impact. He was deferential toward the Supreme Court and its autonomy, just as he was, by and large, toward Congress and its legislative autonomy. One of his major appointments, of course, was of his good friend David Davis, who had presided over the 8th Judicial Circuit when Lincoln rode that circuit in the late 1840s and 1850s. But those appointments to the Supreme Court shaped it for years to come, and it was in that sense that he had an influence. I don't believe that he ever tried to shape its own thinking. Few presidents have, and those who have sometimes come to some grief in doing so. But those 5 appointments were important.
Cullum Davis is at the Lincoln Herndon Law Firm offices down across from the old state capitol here in Springfield, Illinois. If you've never been to this part of the world, we've mentioned it earlier, you're only about a 3.5-hour drive from Chicago. It's all interstate, I-55, and the same is true coming from St. Louis, although the timing is only about 90 minutes or so. Edna Medford and David Long are here in the house at 8th and Jackson here in Springfield. You can see on the screen the relative towns in Mr. Lincoln's life. Another one is Charleston, which is not on that map, where his father Thomas is buried near there. And his mother is buried, Nancy Hanks Lincoln, in Lincoln City down in southern Indiana. And we go next to Tracy, California. Go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have one comment and two questions. My comment, I wish to recommend to the Lincoln aficionados the 1992 ABC TV movie called Lincoln, in which the story is shown through photographs and voiceovers by Jason Robards, Oprah Winfrey, and Richard Dreyfuss. It's a very nice educational film. Also, the accompanying musical CD soundtrack by Alan Menken is also very good. My two questions. First, what other information do you have on Robert Lincoln's son, such as his age at the time of his death? And my second question is, in speculation saying that Lincoln served his second term, how would he have fared with the Reconstruction issue, which later brought Andrew Johnson? I don't see how he would have succeeded in getting anything passed with the Radical Republicans. I'll take the answer on the air. Thank you very much.
Let's go to the Reconstruction first, David Long.
Been one of the real contentious issues among Lincoln historians over the years as to what Lincoln would have done had he lived to be president during Reconstruction. Certainly, anybody who was president during Reconstruction was going to have difficulty. It was a difficult time. Of course, it was made all the more difficult by the very tense, and it even got ugly, situation between Andrew Johnson and the Radical Republicans in Congress. Lincoln would not have had that much difficulty with the Radical Republicans. He had handled them pretty well during the war. My inclination, I was just talking with Edna about this a little while ago, is that Lincoln would have been much more involved in assuring that the gains for the freedmen, for the former slaves, would be preserved, and that their safety would be secured. Of course, there's no way of knowing.
Let me show the audience the cemetery, the Oak Ridge Cemetery, which is not very far from here, where Mr. Lincoln and his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, are buried. There you can see the obelisk, which, by the way, this has all been changed a couple of times. That was actually heightened a number of years ago from where it is right now. And buried here are the three of his four children and Mary Todd Lincoln. He was originally buried in a vault down below in the back of this area for 6 months, then moved to the side of the hill, then moved here, where you can see the designation. Eddie died in 1850. He was 4 years old at the time. Willie, you can see, died in 1862, which was 3 years before the president was shot. And Tad Lincoln lived until 1871. And Robert Todd Lincoln, I want somebody to pick up on this at this point. Tell us what he went on to do and how many years did he live? Edna Medford or Cullum Davis?
I certainly don't remember when his son may have died, but he went on to... One very important thing he did was to head the Pullman Company after its founder died. I'd like to very briefly address, however, the whole issue of what Lincoln might have done had he... survived.
Hold on just a second, because I don't know, we have more videotape left of the grave area. I want to make sure that we see the entire part of this. Cullum Davis, do you know anything more about Robert Todd Lincoln and when he was Secretary of War?
Well, he was, as you say, Secretary of War. He also was a very successful corporate attorney, founded an important law firm in Chicago, which survived by the name Isham Lincoln and Beale until maybe 10, 15 years ago. He had a summer home in, New Hampshire, I believe, Hildene. Was a very successful, financially successful person. Temperamentally, he couldn't have been more different from his father. He was a rather cold, austere figure, not beloved the way his father had been.
Edna Medford, had he lived?
Yes, I'm not quite as optimistic as Professor Long that Lincoln would have done anything very different from what Johnson did. In fact, Johnson initially is following Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction. Lincoln proposes before his death a 10% plan, suggesting that when 10% of the voters from 1860 for any seceded state declares its loyalty to the Union, then that's one of the provisions by which that state could re-enter the Union. It's a very conciliatory plan, and all he does basically in terms of holding out any kind of hope for African-American involvement in politics or inclusion in American society is a letter that he sends to Governor Hahn of Louisiana, suggesting that perhaps the more intelligent of African-Americans and those who had served in the war might be given the right to vote. But he doesn't go beyond that. Certainly there's a possibility that he would have eventually, but he doesn't show that by the time of his death.
By the way, if you've just tuned in, this is all you've ever seen on C-SPAN of Lincoln. You should know that these programs are all being repeated at 8 o'clock on Friday nights. But we have had hundreds of hours of Abraham Lincoln over the last 20 years, and a lot of it's available in our archive, and a lot of it will be played in addition to this three-hour program on Friday night. So you can see other things, including Harold Holzer's tour of the exhibit at the Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Bradenton, Florida, you're next. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to thank you. I don't want to bother you historians. I wanted to thank you for reminding me of my history. I carried papers at Lincoln's home back in 1940 for the afternoon paper. You showed a picture of Lincoln's tomb. Did you see this shiny nose? He had people rub that for luck when they went in to sign it. Say, I walked the Lincoln Trail maybe a half a dozen times. You screwed up one of my trivia questions, who was Lincoln's vice president, because no one ever knew about Hannibal Hamlin. And for your gentleman downtown, I was in offices in the Myers Building, the Illinois Building, and another. I used to look at the courthouse all the time. And I wanted to thank you for my history lesson.
Thank you for the call. We'll go to Belding, Michigan. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to tell you that you were discussing earlier the states that were free and which ones were slave during the Civil War. When Alabama was a southern state, but the county of Winston said that if Alabama could secede from the Union, then they could secede from Alabama. So they were known as the Free State of Winston, and still are. It's in more in the northern part of Alabama.
Thanks. David Long?
There was, as Colin indicated earlier, there were pockets of Union sympathy throughout the South. Probably the best known area, of course, was eastern Tennessee, resulting eventually at Lincoln Memorial University there. But there were areas of northern Alabama in particular that strongly supported the Union, areas of western North Carolina, for example, and of course West Virginia was part of Virginia until the western counties chose to break away from Virginia.
Colin Davis, what did, from what you're reading in all of Abraham Lincoln, what did he sound like?
Well, let me, if I may first, Brian, comment further on David's observation. The opposite is true as well. There were pockets of pro-slavery sentiment throughout the North, including, I might add, Sangamon County, Lincoln's home county, which was not all that enthusiastic about his presidential campaign in either 1860 or 1864. Now I've, of course, forgotten your question.
No, I was just, these are just personal questions. How tall was he?
Oh, he was, what, 6'4" tall. He had a rather high pitched voice, actually. Not squeaky exactly, but not the basso profundo that many actors have laid upon him. He had something of a rural twang to that voice, and some people even think of it or thought of it as a southern dialect. So it wasn't the kind of voice that automatically attracted attention and respect. It was the words that emanated from that voice that made the difference.
Now, this is a question I don't know that I've ever asked before about somebody that way back when. Do you have any idea what his handshake was like? Anybody here, David Long?
Everything I'm led to understand is it was a very firm handshake. I think of January 1st, 1863, the day that he's going to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, there has been a White House reception that morning. Of course, this is an important occasion. He has shaken the hands of hundreds of people. And at noon, when they go up into the what would then be the executive office, what in the Oval Office then, he picks up the pen with all of these dignitaries around, picks up the pen to write the emancipation or write his signature, and his hand is trembling, and he puts the pen down and turns and says, you know, if my name goes into history, it will be for this act, and I want everyone to know that I firmly believe it. If my hand seems to shake when I sign it, then people will throughout history say he didn't really know if it was the right thing or not. He said, I've been shaking hands all morning, my hand is numb. He said, and now he reaches down a second time, picks the pen up, his hand is steady, and then he signs it. But that's just one instance of where his handshake has, we know something of what it did to him in that occasion.
Colm Davis, Edna Medford, and David Long, if you'll stand by for a moment. Linda Norbert Suits is back with us with some more views of the house here. Where are you now, Linda Suits?
I'm heading up the front stairs. We left when I left you last at the front door, and there were stairs behind me, and we're going up those stairs up into Lincoln's bedroom. This, when the house was made a full two stories, this became Mr. Lincoln's bedroom. And this is where he slept in the evening. Behind me is a desk where he could do some work when he was up here. But my favorite part of this room is the shaving mirror that's to my right. Lincoln, as you said, was 6'4" tall. This is set for a man of 6'4" tall.
Can you stand over there next to it so we can get an idea of how, and how tall are you?
I'm probably about 5'11".
Get over there near a little closer to it. And he said he was 6'4", so
yes,
he would look right into that mirror.
Right into that mirror. And he shaved every morning. He was clean shaven the entire time he lived here. It was not until shortly before he left for Washington that he grew the beard. So he used his razor every morning. He sharpened it here every morning. He looked in this mirror and he shaved himself. He tried to comb back his hair. He's said to have unruly, dark, coarse hair, and he talked about his dark coarse hair, and even in his photographs, early ones, you can see it's mussed up a lot. So it would be here that he'd be trying to put it down in the mornings to make it behave before he went out. And I can even see Mary, who shared the room next door, coming in and having him bend low over her because she was only 5'4" tall, and trying to smooth his hair down in the morning before he went out to make it presentable to the world.
One of the things I want to ask you about is that carpeting up there, or rug, or whatever you call that, and maybe Greg Fabry can get a real good close shot of it. That gray carpeting off to the right is stuff that you've put down for visitors here. But what is this?
This is called ingrain carpet. These were chosen, they're patterns from the time period. We don't know exactly what kind of carpet the Lincolns had, but this was popular at the time period, and it's a woven wool carpet that lots of folks would have had in their house. And you look at the carpet and the wallpaper, and a lot of people sort of gasp at the color combinations and pattern combinations, but it was something very popular at the time period. This wallpaper we point out to everyone. This is a reproduction of the exact paper that Mary Lincoln chose for her house. When this second story was added, she purchased this paper for these rooms. And I think it says a lot about Mary, the pattern. Now, she suffered from migraines, and a lot of people say they know why when they see this paper, because of the wild pattern. But this was something that she appreciated, and it was an expensive paper. Lincoln's law practice was doing really well. And he could afford a paper that perhaps even came from France. It's hand-blocked. And put this throughout his room. And we show it in her room as well. They had a suite of rooms.
Let me ask you about this. And, of course, this would be the 1999 question. Did they sleep in the same room, the same bed, or do we care, or do we know?
They did until they added the second story and the back of the house that allowed them to have a suite of rooms. It was a common practice of the time that to have a suite of rooms. Mary's sister, Elizabeth, who was married to the son of the territorial governor, also socially very prominent in Springfield, had separate rooms from her husband. So it was something that if you could afford it, you did. It was always very practical for the Lincolns. He worked into the evening. She liked to read into the evening. And she also suffered from migraines, so it was a place where she could go in quiet and dark when she was suffering from migraine.
We had a call earlier, and I must say I didn't understand it completely because I guess I didn't hear what you said earlier, but there was some criticism of you and a statement you made earlier. Did you hear that call?
No, I didn't.
Something to the effect, did you say anything about this would not be your choice of work earlier? You remember saying that when Edna Medford, do you remember that call?
What she said was that she hadn't planned to do that, but I got the impression that she was very pleased that she was involved in this. But no, I didn't hear that she said she... this would not have been her choice.
But the caller seemed to be criticizing our guest, Linda Suits. I just wanted to make sure you give me a chance to react to this. You've done this for 8 years, and is it something that you wanted to do for 8 years?
Oh, yes. I enjoy it very, very much. I've learned a lot working here. It's just a lot of people set their sights on being a Lincoln Scholar, and that was never my goal, but I enjoy every minute here, and I've learned a lot and feel privileged to have been able to work here.
But you are giving this up.
Yes, I am.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to stay home for a little while with my children. My husband and I and my family have talked about it for a long time, and we think that my little people at home are the real important thing right now, and that's what I'm going to do for a little while.
And they are 6 and 4?
6 and 4.
And what else can you show us before we wrap this part of our little tour up?
We can just walk into Mary's room. It's a little bit more of an intimate feel in here. The ceiling is lower. It's 9 feet. It's 11 feet in Lincoln's room. So it's a little bit more of a closed-in feel. And there were stoves in these rooms that made them warm. And Mary also, she sewed a lot for her family. And we also illustrate a sewing table in this room because of all the sewing that Mary did.
Again, we talked about this earlier, but what was the relationship, you think, between the two of them? And did it ever sour for a very long period of time?
There were rough spots. There were rough spots, I think, in most people's marriage. She could be difficult. He could be difficult as well. I mean, there were lots of complaints that he never came home time for dinner. They'd send the boys frequently to come and get him, and he'd sort of ignore the boys, and the dinner would be charred. There's another account that he was watching the boys one day, had them in a wagon, and was walking up and down the street and was reading a book, and one of the children fell out of the wagon, and he didn't notice because he was so wrapped up in other things. So I think that says a little bit about how he could become wrapped up in other things and not pay attention to what was going on around him, which would be hard for her.
What's the difference between the way that Mary Todd Lincoln related to the four boys and her family and the way he did?
They're both very close to their children. I think they had a similar feeling for how to raise children. They were both very indulgent, and they loved their children very, very much.
From all the tours you've seen come through here, what is the favorite thing for young people when they walk through this house?
For young people, actually, a lot of them, it's the privy in the backyard. They haven't seen anything like that before, and they're real intrigued to see that. And inside the house, although it is not Abraham Lincoln's house, I think it's the hat downstairs they like a lot, too.
When did this, in our society, when would a house like this have indoor plumbing?
It depended on the family. It came in different times depending on when you could afford it, but it would have been later in the century. Although gas lighting was slowly creeping its way towards this house in this neighborhood, and it would have been just shortly after the Lincolns left that gas would have been available for the inside of the house.
Linda Norbert Suits, thank you very much for taking us on a little bit more of a tour.
You're very welcome.
We're going to go back to the phones. Cullum Davis is downtown at the law offices. Edna Medford is here in our parlor area of the house, along with David Long, and we go to Vienna, West Virginia. Go ahead, please. Hello, Vienna. You're
Hello.
On here.
Hello, Brian Lamb.
Hi.
I'm in my 7th decade, and yet I consider you a mentor. I enjoy C-SPAN so much in my retirement years, and I just want to tell you one thing. I have no question. I want to tell you that I visited, as a young man, the Lincoln Tomb. And for some reason, I think it was raining hard, I was the only one in that room with the tomb. And I still remember it vividly. And I don't know. It was just a wonderful experience. And more power to you, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks. Actually, I was out there yesterday, and there wasn't anybody else around.
See, the family decided it would be too much of a burden taking the dog with them. So I want to thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. David Long, do you have any idea what $83,000 would be worth today?
Oh, it would be the equivalent of being a millionaire today, clearly.
But there's stories about Mrs. Lincoln ended up with no money. And
well, she had a great deal of difficulty. After that, there were challenges on the estate. She had trouble getting money out of the estate. She would later petition congressmen to bail her out of situations that she was in. Yeah, she did a fair amount of traveling in the years afterwards. I'm not sure how much of the money would have been eaten up by that. She had, of course, a very ill son, Tad, who had to be taken care of. I'm not sure I can give you a real good answer as to why she had the problem she did financially, but certainly she did.
Los Alamos, New Mexico, next. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to thank you for your excellent programming. I have a question on Robert Todd Lincoln. We visited his home in Manchester, Vermont, and I wondered if C-SPAN was going to visit. And then they titled the state as Hill Dean. It's a beautiful estate.
Yeah, thanks for the call. We have been there before, but undoubtedly we'll go back. It is located right outside the little village there of Manchester. And Robert Todd Lincoln, I think one of the interesting stories I remember telling is when William Howard Taft came to visit him. He was about 300 pounds at least at that point, and they used to put the bed on the floor because he couldn't get in the bed. And then in the morning, you have to bring people in to get him up, pull him up from the floor. Have anybody that on the program is Mr. Davis? Have you been to Hill Dean?
No, I haven't, Brian. I have not visited.
How about the folks in this room? I think I asked earlier. Let's go on to Silver Spring, Maryland next. Go ahead, please.
Yes. When I was a very... Oh, wait a minute. Let me put on mute. When I was a young college student, I had a friend who went to Dartmouth, and he said that a history professor of his had said that the eloquence and brilliance of Abraham Lincoln was due to the fact that his mother, Nancy, was the illegitimate daughter of Patrick Henry. I have never, ever heard that story again, but I wondered if anyone else knew anything about it.
Ed
Thank
Medford.
You.
There has been a lot of question about who she was exactly. We only know about her mother. We don't know who her father was. Not just Patrick Henry has been mentioned, but Thomas Jefferson and a lot of other people. Yes, a lot of some historians have suggested that she descended from a prominent Virginia planter and that she was illegitimate. And Lincoln himself allegedly told Herndon that he feared his mother was illegitimate, and that was a great source of embarrassment to him. But at the same time, according to Herndon, Lincoln felt that any kind of intelligence that he got came through his mother as a consequence of her having been fathered perhaps by this Virginia gentleman. But of course, we really don't know.
Costa Mesa, California. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Thank you for this series. I had two thoughts to ask your group guests about. In many photographs of Lincoln, his hair is parted on the left side, but there are a couple, it's on the right side. And I know it's not an error in reversing the printing because the mole is on the right side of his face. Could your guest comment, please?
Phelim Davis, you have any idea?
Brian, I haven't the slightest idea as to Lincoln's habits in parting his hair on the right or the left. I'm sorry.
Well, as somebody who's always had pretty unruly hair myself, I can say there are days that you wake up and your hair insists on not doing what you want it to do. You end up doing the best you can to cause it to lie down, to not be unruly. I think there were probably days that it was easier to make it go in one direction than in the other.
Let me ask off subject that we're talking about right now. Anybody can jump in on this. Mr. Lincoln was a captain in the Black Hawk during the Black Hawk War. He also had a position he took on the Mexican War. Mr. Davis, anything on that from you, the Black Hawk involvement?
Well, that was an important experience in his adolescent, early adult life. He volunteered to serve when he was living as a newcomer in New Salem Village. And one of the important things about it is that he was quickly elected to lead his particular military detachment, which is an early sign of his leadership potential and stature. For him, it was an interesting experience. He later laughed that he didn't really learn anything militarily about it, but that he did fight some mosquitoes and suffered from the walking around southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. He didn't develop an anti-war feeling from that, though it is certainly true that he was very critical of the administration's policy toward Mexico, namely President Polk's policy, with the famous spot resolution that he had introduced in Congress. Some might have thought from that he was a pacifist, which isn't fair to say, obviously, in light of the Civil War experience, but he was very critical of the administration's more or less contriving, in his view, a war with Mexico.
Edna Medford, we had a caller ask about this portrait earlier. What is it?
It's a charcoal drawing, I believe, by Charles White, the Harlem Renaissance, African-American Harlem Renaissance artist. And certainly it does reflect its artistic license. White is drawing Lincoln in the way that he sees him. The person who brought that in does indicate that there are some features that would suggest that he has he's of African-American descent. I think it's simply the artist just giving his version of his Lincoln.
And I'm holding this so you can see. If we pull back, Garrett, you can give the audience an idea of how big this is. That and I give, you can pull back a little bit farther if you can. I don't know, so we can see how it relates to a human being. There we go. It's a nice big portrait. We go to Niles, Michigan next. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I had heard rumors that Abraham Lincoln was a closet homosexual. Is this true?
It is not a rumor. There's been some recent developments in this area, Mr. Long.
Yeah, there are specific allegations. There are claims have been made. That
Coming from where?
I'm not that familiar with the person. I know the
Larry
person,
Kramer.
Larry Kramer, has had, I guess, a history of involvement in some causes that center around homosexuality, gay movement. My first reaction is, so what? I don't know that anybody can say with absolute certainty what Lincoln's sexual orientation or practices were. Nobody knew him personally, who's with us today, and he didn't reveal those things in his public statements or his private utterances. But if so, would it make the Emancipation Proclamation any less important?
Let me ask Colm Davis. One of the allegations includes a man named Joshua Speed, who is from this area. Do you know much about him, and do you know anything about this story?
Yes, Lincoln befriended Joshua Speed when Lincoln moved to Springfield in April of 1837, about to practice law. And he actually rented space from Speed above Speed's store on the square. And in fact, they did share a bed. What, of course, has to be remembered there is the same point I made about the Globe Tavern, that the notion of men sharing a bed in the 1840s or 30s is far different from the notion today.
I remember correctly that Stephen A. Douglas and Abraham Lincoln shared a bed in Galena?
I don't know about that, but I do know that on the 8th Judicial Circuit, when the lawyers rode that circuit with Judge Davis, they would stay in inns and taverns in various county seats, and there would be two or three or four men sharing the same rope bed in the attic of some inn. So it's erroneous to draw inferences from that. I would agree with David Long that in terms of his presidency, it doesn't really matter. But I would also say that the person who has leveled this claim seems to have a political reason, would have a political reason for doing so, and he has stated that he has a document, namely a Joshua Speed diary, I think he called it, but he's refused to show that to other historians, and so the skeptic in me as an historian says, show me the proof, and then I'll make a comment.
Harwich, Massachusetts, out in Cape Cod. Go ahead, please.
My name is Hayes, Jim Hayes, and you're touching on Lincoln's lineage, and his mother prompted this question. I've read Carl Sandburg's three volumes on Lincoln, and in the first one he traces from their ancestors landing in Massachusetts And actually, there's a statue of Lincoln in a little town, Hingham, where I live, to substantiate some of these facts. And from there, there was migration into Virginia. And this would be Lincoln's grandfather, who was persuaded there to go west. And in his efforts, I guess, just before he started, they were into farming, and there was Indians involved. And he had three sons, did Lincoln's grandfather. And these sons were out in this field, and he was attacked by the Indians. And Lincoln's father was the youngest, and his brothers protected him. And there was one of the brothers killed, as far as I recall. And I'm wondering how history's line would be affected if Lincoln's father was one of the casualties.
Edna Medford.
Yeah, the family does start out from England to Massachusetts to Pennsylvania to Virginia, Rockingham County, Virginia. And part of the family does end up in Kentucky. What happened was when the father died, there were three sons, but during that period, the oldest son inherited everything. And as a consequence, Lincoln's father, being the youngest, really had to make his way on his own. And so a family that was fairly prosperous, that particular branch of the family had to struggle a little bit more. If Lincoln's father had been killed early on, who knows if the man that we know as Lincoln would have existed. Certainly his relationship with his father was very interesting and very complex as well. And what he becomes is very much in part a reaction to who he felt his father was and his attempt to better him.
You've just joined us. This is the 16th in a series of 41 programs devoted to American presidents over a 41-week period. We are in Springfield, Illinois. One of the main purposes of all this is for education, and we have done a lot of things for teachers free of charge, and we'll give you the telephone number to call if you want to call our education department and become involved. We'll send you the all information. There's still more material to come out as the year goes on, and the telephone number is 202-626-4858. There is someone there right now to take your call, or if it's on a videotape replay later on, you can just call the number and leave a message and folks will call you back. Those are for classroom teachers only at 202-626-4858 and at cspan.org/classroom. We've had a lot of involvement and there's still plenty of time in this series to join in on all this, and especially getting ready for the fall. There'll be videotapes available, websites, lesson plans. 202-626-4858. And we're running out of time. We only have a little bit more than 10 minutes. We go next to Everson, Washington. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yes, my name is Linda Loveson, and my question is very short and simple. I was raised with the picture that Abraham Lincoln taught himself to read sitting by a fireside. Is this true? And also, is it true that he taught himself to read by reading the Bible?
Thanks. And you forgot to add one important part of all this. He was doing this all when he was in the state of Indiana, I believe. David Long, is that correct?
Yes. Lincoln had probably in his lifetime maybe the equivalent of one year of education. So he did learn in school some basics, some rudimentary reading and writing, and as he put it, ciphering to the rule of three. So he had education got started with him. After that, most of it would be done by himself. The fact that he has become one of the great literary stylists in American history is the remarkable thing when you consider the lack of formal education.
Colum Davis, have you read all of the legal material that is in this series that's going to be released next year?
I have not personally inspected every single document of the 100,000 or so, but I've inspected a lot of them. And my colleagues, some seven historians working with me, have in fact carefully inspected those documents in order to be able to write the case descriptions that are a major feature of the product that we're going to publish.
Tom Swartz, who is an Illinois State historian and we've done a lot with over the years, not with us this morning live, but for those watching this program live, there will be a chat room at the end of this program with Tom Swartz. And we've seen a lot of him in the past and we'll see a lot of him in the future. There are just so many people involved in the whole Lincoln story. It was impossible for us to get everybody involved in this 1 3-hour program. We have another call from Springfield, Illinois, right here in the city where we are. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Joel. I have always heard a couple of myths about Abraham Lincoln. that I thought Mr. Cullen Davis could probably answer, or some of the other historians. One was that during the 1860 election, after very late at night, about midnight, when the final election returns came through, that Lincoln had been in the telegraph office, which was about two doors down from where Mr. Davis is sitting. He went outside. He didn't say anything once he was told he had been elected. He went outside, put his top hat on the ground, did a somersault in the street, picked up the hat, walked home and told Mary, "We're elected." The other thing was is that, Brian, I appreciate your somewhat offbeat questions about the different personalities of the individuals, and specifically about the handshake. It's also my understanding that one of the more famous sculpture of Lincoln's hands that are available in gift shops around Springfield has one with a stick through it, and that stick was a result of Lincoln's sculptor wanting to get a relatively good cast of the hand. Lincoln had been shaking hands all day and was unable to make a fist, so the sculptor picked up a broomstick out of the kitchen there in the Lincoln home and had him hold the stick, which is why the two hands, one has a stick and one doesn't. Maybe Mr. Davis can verify that as well.
Colonel Davis?
Well, the somersaulting Lincoln on the news of his election is a story that obviously cannot be proven. It's a little hard to imagine that a man who treasured his clothing and was some 6 feet 4 inches tall would have done a somersault, but that's part of the great story of Lincoln. As to his hand, it is true, in fact, that cast of his hand around a handle was because he had been shaking hands. What the viewers might infer from that story and the one that David Long told about his shaking hands in reception, that Lincoln's musculature was rather modest. But in fact, he had enormous upper body arm strength. He could hold a broad axe out, straight out, which was an impressive accomplishment. It's just that he shook so many hands that his hand tended to tremble. And whether for a signing or for a casting, it was important to recover from that experience.
One of the things we haven't even touched on is the Civil War, and I've kind of done it on purpose because once you get into that, you'll never ever talk about anything else, and there's plenty of time to deal with that in other venues. But go to the end of this man's life, Edna Medford. He was 56 years old. He died on April the 15th, 1865. There was a 20-day funeral after that. Why?
Well, because so many Americans identified with him. He was the first martyred president, the first one to be assassinated. And so when his body was being returned to Springfield, they went to a lot of the different cities on the way, and it took a long time to get him back home.
Did the Negroes, the blacks, the African Americans at that time, and I know those different names have been used since then, did they turn out for the funeral procession, the train along the way?
Indeed they did. They certainly did identify with him. One of the reasons why we have the whole myth of the Great Emancipator is because at that time it's developing the idea that Lincoln single-handedly freed the slaves. And of course African Americans bought into that as well, not because they believed that the Emancipation Proclamation freed all enslaved people, but because they saw him as a symbol that eventually they could be included as equal partners in American society.
Let's go next to Sonoma, California, above San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. excuse me, I have a cold. My grandmother used to tell me that she came from Centralia, Illinois. I'm 76, and she told me that Lincoln used to come, excuse me, to her home quite a few Sundays. He would show up and have fried chicken dinner with them, and I was so proud that I could stand up in front of the class and tell them that I had a grandmother that had Abraham Lincoln in their house every Sunday. Oh, I was so proud. And I've been through his home and his tomb and everything so many times when I lived in Illinois, because I'm an Illinois person. And I loved Lincoln. Please don't slaughter him like you're trying to do with this Negro bit and a homosexual. Please don't do that. That's horrible about him. It's just horrible to say things like that about him. He was a wonderful man. And I'm so proud to have had my grandmother know him. Thank you very much.
Next call, Topeka, Kansas. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. We out here in bloody Kansas are convinced that the Civil War began here, not at Fort Sumter, because in the 50s, you know, there were abolitionists, there were free staters, secessionists, pro-slavery, and there was much killing, bloodshed, thievery. So we're convinced, and we wish that more of the historians would recognize, you know, we also here in Kansas produced the first black men to fight in the Civil War. But anyway, so if we could get the historians to look just a little bit further west on occasion. Tom Goodrich, the author, has authored four exceptional books about bloody Kansas. But nonetheless, we certainly do enjoy your series. And the one question that I have is, I had been given to understand that Mary Lincoln had a tendency to overspend when she got to the White House in order to furnish and change things around. And I would like your comments.
David Long. Whenever I teach a course on sectionalism and Civil War, the part that Kansas plays is very significant. In the 1850s, after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and the colors is correct. It's almost like a preview of the Civil War takes place on the plains of Kansas as pro-slavery settlers from the south and free soil settlers from the north settle in settlements very close to one another and will do battle for a period lasting almost a couple of years. As to what was the second part of the call, I wanted to say something as well. What did he...
There's a great silence here, and we were listening so intently to what you had to say, we can't remember. And we are running out of time, but thanks, caller, very much for calling us from Topeka. Before we do run out of time, I want to make sure I mention once again the appreciation we have here for Norm Helmers, who is in charge of this whole Lincoln Historic Site for the National Park Service. And Kim Rosendahl, who we did not thank earlier, and Nikki Stratton, and also, of course, Linda Suits, and Tim Townsend, who were on this program earlier in the 3 hours. And Mark Farkas, along with Marty Dominguez, who are co-producers for this entire series. Marty Dominguez back in Washington, Mark Farkas on the road a lot, and involved with the programming itself, and Brett Betzel, our director here on site with our C-SPAN crew. We go next to San Dimas, California. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm calling with regards to Lincoln's three sons. I believe it was stated earlier in the program that they all died. However, I saw a biography on a major network stating that Mary Lincoln quite possibly went insane after Lincoln's assassination and was eventually committed by her son. I was wondering on comments on this. Thank you very much.
Talking about Robert Todd Lincoln committing her, Edna Medford?
She certainly did have a hard time after his assassination. But, of course, her sorrow was not over. Her one son does die in 71 as well. And so things were very difficult for her. Robert, her oldest son, does eventually get her committed. She's released after a while. But it just devastated her that her own son would do that to her.
Colin Davis, how much did that impact the reason why Robert Todd Lincoln is buried at Arlington Cemetery instead of back here with the rest of the family?
I can't speak to that, frankly, Brian, but it is true that her mental condition deteriorated over time. You don't take a static picture of that relationship between the two of them. Her losing three sons and a husband in the form that it occurred, and then having money problems and being accused of having Confederate sympathies, inevitably affected her mental ability.
Last call, Cookeville, Tennessee. You're next.
Hello there.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
We're doing well. How are you? And what would you like to comment on?
And the last caller. There's a place in Jackson County, Tennessee, that says that Mr. Lincoln's parents were born there. Do any of you have any knowledge of that? And also,
Jackson County, Tennessee, Lincoln's parents, David Long, you're shaking your head.
Not to my knowledge.
Let me ask the three of you before we say goodbye. What was your PhD in, David Long?
United States history, emphasis on the mid-19th century.
And you got your PhD at what school?
Florida State University.
And Edna Medford, what was yours?
American history with an emphasis on African-American history in 19th century South.
Cullum Davis?
American political history at the University of Illinois.
Now, we've talked a lot about Abraham Lincoln, a lot of positive about him. Is there one thing that you did not like about him? Let's go around the horn one more time, and I'll start with Edna Medford. What did you not like about Abraham Lincoln?
Oh, gosh, we don't have enough time. No, actually, I felt that he moved too slowly in pressing for emancipation during the war. I think Benjamin Quarles was right. He led from behind. I do have a problem with his colonization schemes early on. I certainly recognize that he grew while he was president. But certainly when he started out, he was not a president that would have been acceptable to African Americans during that period, and he was not. By the end of the war, certainly they're changing their opinion of him.
Cullum Davis?
Well, I would largely agree. A tendency toward passivity and temporizing on fundamentally explosive issues in American society. But again, as in all these matters, he had a capacity to learn and grow and develop, so that the ultimate judgment of him is one that is, I think, unequivocally favorable.
And David Long?
I would agree wholeheartedly with Edna that this is a man who grew. This is a man who, by the end of the war, especially given the experience the last year and a half or so of the war, had become a towering figure. It would be the young Lincoln that I would probably find more fault with than any other time in his life. There were he and Mary, at one time before they were married, when they were involved in Springfield politics, wrote a letter to the editor, apparently wrote a letter to the editor, very mean-spirited letter about an opposing politician, which almost led to a duel taking place. But I think that Lincoln learned from that experience that, you know, words can be cruel and have an effect, and that people, you can hurt people by how you treat them and what you say. And as I say, it would probably be Lincoln of that earlier generation that I would find the most fault with.
David Long teaches at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. Edna Medford teaches at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And Cullum Davis is the director of the Lincoln Legal Papers and is originally from Peoria, Illinois. Edna Medford, originally from Charles City, Virginia. And David Long, Middletown, Ohio. Thank you all very much for joining us today here in Springfield. Next stop, July 9th, which is Greenville, Tennessee, and the home and the tailor shop of Andrew Johnson. Good day.
We rebuilt and re-edited all the stuff, and it sounds pretty good. Let's see how it does if anybody really likes this. Now, if you like it, download some more, plus my zip files, Johnny 81 and his zip files. See if you like them.